Hi, and welcome to this special edition of the Macro Show, where you wonder, is disinflation coming? Well, we're going to answer that question by taking a look at the quarterly investment report from Hoisington Investment Management, which I consider required reading in the kingdom. I'm your host, Steve Van Meter, and let's get right into this. If you've never been to the Hoisington Investment Management website, I've got a link to it below where you can access this quarterly report and some of their past reports. Let's get right into this. So the case for disinflation or decelerating inflation. Now, contrary to conventional wisdom, disinflation is more likely than accelerating inflation, something we've talked about on the show. Since prices deflated in the second quarter of 2020, the annual inflation rate will move transitorily higher. Now, this is what you call base effects. So from the pandemic shutdown, we saw some very low CPI prints. Well, those are going to move higher just because of the year-over-year effects. Now, once these base effects are exhausted, cyclical, structural, and monetary considerations, he gets into the monetary considerations in the last page, so hang tight, suggested the inflation rate will moderate lower by year-end. It's going to be more than just that, and will undershoot the Federal Reserve's target of 2%. That will not be a problem. This is going to be a blip over 2% and then a pullback. The inflationary psychosis that has gripped the bond market will fade away in the face of such persistent deflation. Well, that's great news, especially in the kingdom here. All right, let's get in the next section. We're not going to go through every bit, but we're going to go through quite a bit. The cyclical effects, it says the U.S. growth rate this year could be the fastest since 1984. Now, this is true. You go from a contraction to a reopening, and yes, that can happen, and possibly even since 1950. Now, he goes through five considerations to suggest that such growth is not likely to lead to sustaining inflation. Now, first, inflation is a lagging indicator. We've talked about this on the show, and keep in mind, you know, prices rise and then they hit the factory and then they eventually get to the consumer. So they are a lagging indicator as classified by the National Bureau of Economic Research, or NBER. And let's go on. The low inflation occurred after all. Low inflation incurred after all of the past four recessions. Now remember, we've shown charts where where treasury yields go down after a recession. Well, there's a reason, because inflation goes down with an average lag of almost 15 quarters from end of recessions. That's how I know the bond kingdom will receive its eventual glory no matter what. Maybe if it's not on my timetable, it will certainly get there. So you can see there in the chart, the lag in quarters, inflation trials after recession, 17.2976 average 15 months there. Now, I'll let you read some of the other stuff on your own, but let's move into the second piece of this, which is productivity. So productivity rebounds and recoveries and vigorously so in the aftermath of deep recessions. So what does that mean? That means employees are more productive than they were before. And we'll talk about that in the fourth section of how that actually happens. But productivity rebounded by an average of almost 5% in the year immediately after the end of these prior recessions in 49, 58, and 82. And unit labor costs, so that means cost of employees, so you think wages, right? And that's really where you want to see inflation from wage growth, were unchanged. The rise in productivity held down unit labor costs. Well, it makes perfect sense. If you can get more work out of an employee, you don't need more employees. Pretty simple. All right, let's go on to the third. The restoration of the supply chains will be disinflationary. And low-cost producers in Asia and elsewhere were unable to deliver as much product into the United States and other relatively high-cost countries, simply due to supply chain problems. This allowed U.S. producers to gain market share. As immunizations increase, supply chains will be gradually restored. And, you know, we've talked about this in the show where, you know, people say, well, the reopening economy is going to be really inflationary. No, it's not, because it's going to reopen supply chains. It's going to be very disinflationary when we find out just how much product and inventory is sitting in ports and on ships all around the world. Thus, the pandemic cost low-cost producer. Thus, the pandemic cost the low-cost producers market share, which was shifted to domestic producers. The low-cost producers will want to regain market share, while high-cost producers, whose fortunes were unexpectedly helped, will try to hold on to market share. There's no doubt about that. And this will lead to price wars. Moreover, the core inflation rate is even lower in China. Now, remember, anytime you hear core, you think, excluding food and energy, suggesting that this new additional competition will hold prices down. So all he's saying here is, look, we didn't get inflation out of China, which is usually where it starts because they're an exporting nation. So if they're not exporting inflation, well, then we can't import it, or and it will not be sustained. Fourth, accelerated technological advancement will lower costs. Another restraint on inflation is that the pandemic greatly accelerated the implementation of inventions that were in the pipeline. This is really important. And much of this technology substitutes machines for people, communication without travel, and work without offices. So all of a sudden you've got employees that are more product, or they get more done. I try to say more productivist, but that doesn't make any sense. But they get more work done because they have the technology and the tools to be more efficient. So businesses were forced to fast forward into technology that they were not ready for yet. And now they're finding out that they can get more work out of their employees, and their customers like it too. All right, fifth, eye-popping economic growth numbers based on GDP and present circumstances greatly overstate the presumed significance of the result. This is where the fallacy of the broken glass comes into play. Many businesses failed in the recession of 2020, much more so than normal. As survivors and new firms take over the markets, this will be greatly reflected in GDP, but the costs of these failures will not be deducted. And this is really key, because a lot of people say, I don't get how the economy can look so good when things are bad for me, when they see the GDP numbers this big. Well, it doesn't account for the cost of failure. Let's take a look at the next section, structural impediments. The two main structural impediments to traditional U.S. and global economic growth are massive debt overhang and deteriorating demographics, both which have worsened as a consequence of 2020. These forces are disinflationary, and they reinforce each other. So I'm not going to go through all the demographic part, but we'll go through this first piece here, the ever deeper debt trap. And before the pandemic, economic growth was decelerating, as confirmed by a decline in world trade. So, you know, this is something Dr. Hunt has been talking about. The decline in world trade is a macro indicator to look at in terms of inflation. One of the few yearly declines in history of this series. He goes on to say the 37% surge in debt relative to GDP was a record. While this debt may be politically popular and socially necessary, it will weaken growth and inflation after a transitory spurt. So that's what we're seeing right now, that transitory spurt, which will lead to even more disappointing business conditions that existed prior to the pandemic. That's how we know the worst is actually yet to come. Now, if you want to read about the global debt, you can go through the next couple of paragraphs. The United States has experienced five secular debt surges, the 1820s through the 1830s, the 60s through 1870s, 1920s to 30s, 2000 to 2010, and 2020. The total debt to GDP surged to a new record height in each successive case, including 2020. And while the data for 1820 to 30 is incomplete, no doubt exists a debt peak was in 1973 was higher. Disinflationary conditions occurred in all cases. In all cases with three periods of deflation. So there you go. You got the chart, U.S. debt bubble peaks, and you see the outcome. Deflation, deflation, inflation, disinflation. So you know it's coming because debt that is not turned into an increase in productivity, well, becomes an overhang on the economy. And he goes on to say that this shows the increasing over-reliance on debt to solve economic problems. While the debt works transitorily, real per capita GDP, which is a measure of standard living, continues to lose momentum as debt levels move higher and higher. And that is a problem because debt becomes a drag on the economy if it does not lead to economic growth, which is not. This debt isn't going to. So the disinflationary and deflationary consequence of the debt levels conform with scholarly research from the 19th century to the present that indicates that high debt levels undermine economic growth. This causality is supported by the law of diminishing returns derived from the universally applicable production function. The historical record is consistent with research that the government debt multiplier is negative, meaning, look, everyone thinks that government borrowing is plus for the economy. It is a brief plus before it's negative. So he says the debt multiplier is negative, not positive, and the high levels of gross government debt has a deleterious effect on real per capita GDP growth. So that's pretty interesting. He goes on to say The U.S. government debt reached a record 129.1% of GDP, with new peaks reached in all major foreign economies. Now, again, I'm not going to go through the demographics piece. I think it's pretty obvious, and you can read through that, that, you know, when you have an aging global population and you have fewer births, you can't get demand because you need a lot more demand from those who are here. Well, the easiest way to get demand is from having more people. All right, let's take a look at monetary conditions. And this is some interesting things here because he does refer to a liquidity trap without calling it a liquidity trap. So quantitative measures, M2 increased from 19.2 in 2019 to 2020, the fastest since the 26.4% gain in 1943. However, volatility neutralizes impact on nominal GDP by falling to 1.19. And remember, we talked about how QE puts dollars in prison and kills money velocity. So dropping below the previous record low set 7.5 decades ago. When money increases and velocity falls, the money is trapped in the financial markets. There it is. That is, there he is. He's referring to the liquidity trap right there. And has only a minimally lasting impact on the real economy. Federal Reserve credit also served as the Fed's balance sheet, served 77.4%. So there it is. You're seeing the growth rate of the demand of money is growing more proportionally than the supply of money last year, and has continued to advance this year as the Fed has bought U.S. government and mortgage-backed securities at a rate of $120 billion per month. In terms of price, the Fed considers its policy mix to be stimulative, although we know it's not, and accommodative, which we also know it's not, and the Fed chair and numerous other officials have frequently commented. The other rail of monetary policy, the policy rate, leads to an alternative conclusion. Remember, you know, we have referred to as low rates being disinflationary or deflationary because of the interest component. The policy rate should not be ignored since it is the price mechanism that transmits monetary policy to the broader economy. Price changes shift incentives, and when they do not move, the private sector is not motivated to change behavior. With the policy rate stuck at the zero bound and the Fed strongly opposed to negative rates, which we know they'll get to at some point, but they can't. But that's probably the likely next direction, is they'll figure out a way to do that. The Fed's price mechanism vehicle for monetary transmission is out of action. That's like having your transmission broke in your car. You can idle it, you can rev it, but you don't move. Based on the 70-year history of the policy rate, this suggests the Fed policy actions will be severely enfeebled. This record indicates the policy rate declines well into expansions. Why is that? Why does a policy rate decline well into expansions? To spur lending growth. How do you get people to borrow? Higher rates or lower rates? It's obviously lower. In other words, the federal funds rate, like inflation, is a lagging indicator. Equally important, the rate declines substantially during this period. In chart three, the trials of the policy rate represented by the blue squares occur long after the start of the recession. So he's got this chart up here where you've got the red dots at the beginning, blue dots at the end, telling us that there is a lower low in interest rates coming thanks to how the federal funds rate is. The average difference is 38 months. The only short lags occurred in 50s and 60s when the economy's initial conditions were much stronger than they are presently. Since 1970, none of the lags were less than 26 months. Since the recession started in February 2020, the average post-1970 lag would place a low in federal funds rate in April 2022. That's a year from now. If applying the average lag of 38 months for the entire history, then the low in the policy rate would not happen until April 2023. 2 years from now, and during these long lags, the policy rate declined by an average of 477 basis points. That's a lot. It's like 4.77%. Since the federal funds rate was 1.58 in February 2020, applying historical relationship would mean the policy rate would need to become more negative than the policy rate anywhere else in the world currently. And that, my friends, is the case for how you get the 30-year treasury yield to zero. Role of the banks. Now, this is really interesting because, you know, I like to talk about the banks and their role in the financial system. The depository institutions and their private sector customers play a major role in the transmission of monetary policy. Yeah, by borrowing. It is often incorrectly assumed that ample availability of reserves will lead to an increased lending. is often incorrectly assumed by the Fed that ample availability of reserves will lead to the increase in lending. For loan volumes to rise, the banks must be able to price a risk premium into their loan rates. Now, see, this is, again, something we've talked about, is why don't the banks want to lend? Well, they need to get their money back. Well, if they can't, if they know they're not going to get all their money back, you have to price in defaults. Well, how do you price in defaults when there's not much spread between the amount you're borrowing at and what the rate you're lending at? And their customers must be willing to pay those rates. The measure that captures this process is a loan-to-deposit ratio, which is also considered a lagging indicator, which he's got up here. The total loan-to-deposit ratio is, well, low. In addition, the loan-to-deposit ratio is a key gauge of the profitability of depository institutions, particularly so for the medium and smaller size one. The loan-to-deposit ratio suggests that a reversal in monetary policy is well into the future. This ratio has slumped to a new low for the history of the series that starts in 73. The chairman of the largest U.S. depository institution recently said that he could not make a profit from lending their deposits. There you go. From 1990, when initial conditions began deteriorating significantly, the lag between the start of the recessions and the low in the loan deposit ratio was 39 months, and the lag for policy rate was 45. A replay of lag, such a lag would put a reversal in the spring of 2023 or later. I mean, we've got years before we're out of this mess. And last, let's talk about the bond yield, because if you didn't know, Dr. Lacey Hunt and his partner at Hoisin Investment Management, they are a long-only U.S. government bond, institutional bond managers, and inflation is a key determinant for the level and direction of long-term Treasury yields. Due to the lagging nature of inflation, long Treasury bond yields lag as well. Since the Treasury market began freely trading in the 1950s, the lag between the start of recession and the trial yield averaged 49 months. This gap is quite apparent on the chart, with red dots representing the end of recessions and the blue squares representing bond yields and their cyclical lows. So you can see we're still yet a cyclical low to come, if not more. However, the initial conditions are much worse from 1990 to present than the previous 35 years. Since 1990, the lag between the start of recession and the bond yield trough jumped to 76 months. The economic fundamentals continue to work. At work suggests that the long lags will be a feature in the cycle ahead. While no two cycles are ever alike, the trend in long bond yields remains downward. So there it is, my friends. There is the case for lower Treasury yield and disinflationary pressures from the man himself, Dr. Lacey Hunt at Hoisington Investment Management. Again, I'll link to that in the description below, and we'll be back tomorrow for your regularly scheduled macro show. I'm Steve Van Meter. Thanks for watching. Bye now. The content of this video is provided as educational information only. It is not intended to provide investment advice. This material is not to be construed as a recommendation or solicitation to buy or sell any security, financial instrument, or participate in any particular trading strategy. This video was prepared by Steve Van Meter. Personal capacity opinions expressed this video that do not reflect the view of Atlas Financial Advice, Inc. or Steve Van Meter Financial.